Welcome to the first debate between the two candidates running to represent New York's 24th Congressional District, incumbent Republican John Katko and Democratic challenger Colleen Deacon. I'm Grant Reher, host of the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and we're coming to you from the WRVO studios in Syracuse. The 24th District includes all of Cayuga, Onondaga, and Wayne counties, and the western portion of Oswego County. We don't have a formal set of rules for this conversation, but I do have a number of questions I'd like to put to the two candidates, so I've asked them to keep their answers relatively brief. As always, I wish we had more time. If the conversation runs substantially longer, we may include answers not broadcast here on our website. The full audio of the debate and a full transcript is available at WRVO.org. Congressman Katko, Ms. Deacon, thanks for agreeing to talk with me.
Thanks for having us today. And good luck to you, Colleen.
Good luck to you too, John.
I want to start with some questions about your messaging during this campaign and some of the messaging that's been done on your behalf, particularly television messaging, which is what most voters see. Congressman Katko, when you were here 2 years ago as a challenger, I started with the incumbent for this line of questioning, and so I'll do that again, which means I'll start with you this time. One theme of your messaging is that your opponent is thin on knowledge regarding national and international security. Can you explain that criticism?
Sure. I mean, the bottom line is the national security issues are probably one of the most preeminent issues facing our nation right now, that and jobs in the economy. And anybody running for public office, I think, needs to have at least somewhat of a working knowledge of the issues and have some opinions on them. And so I think it's incumbent upon anybody running for national office. Now, don't forget, this isn't running for, you know, a local office. This is running to be a member of Congress where day in and day out, you're going to be making votes and issuing votes on national security decisions. And she's not immune to this process. She's worked for a senator for 6 years, so she's been exposed to the information on a daily basis. So I think you need to have a little bit more knowledge and a little bit more of a priority placed on it than she has. And on the other hand, I look at myself. I went to Washington. I got placed
on
the
Let me interrupt you there with a follow-up. So the question is why do you think she doesn't have the knowledge? On what basis are you making that?
Her answers and her lack of discussion on the matter. I mean, she doesn't even have anything on her website to discuss the issue or even what her position is. When she's asked the question, what can we do about ISIS? And she basically says, I really don't have a position. Those are her words. There's not anything we took and doctored up. And those are her words. And that was 8 months ago. And since that time, she's had an awful lot of time to develop an answer, and she just hasn't.
Okay. And I'll get to Ms. Deacon for a response to this in a minute, but I did want to ask you another follow-up about this. Don't you think that you yourself have learned a lot about this issue through your experience being in Congress and the committee work that you've done and so on? And wouldn't you think that Colleen Deacon would do the same if she were in office?
Well, of course. Yeah, of course. But also, don't forget, she's worked for a senator for 6 years. She's been exposed to these issues every day. When you're working in a congressional office or a Senate office, you're exposed to these issues on a daily basis. The information flow that comes across your desk is quite significant. And my staff knows more about these issues than I do. And her as a staffer for a senator, I would presume that she knew more about these issues.
So, Ms. Deacon, we'll get into some specific questions about foreign affairs later in the conversation. But for now, can you explain briefly but specifically how you've gone about learning about national and international security as a candidate here for Congress?
Sure. So, well, first I want to, you know, talk about what John Katko just said. I mean, he said, I'm somebody who doesn't have the knowledge about foreign policy. When he took a snippet of my answer and selectively edited what I said, actually what I said on your show, Grant, and you can attest that that wasn't my answer. I had a full response that he just took a portion of to make it sound like I was saying something that I was not saying. Frankly, you know, he feels like he has to mislead the voters and, you know, try to smear my record as somebody who is uninformed.
Let me interrupt again in the same way. But can you tell me how you've gone about learning about national and international security issues as a candidate? What's been your way of learning about this?
Sure. So we do a number of conference calls with generals, with folks on the ground, you know, hearing directly from people who are involved with these issues and, you know, developing strategy for our country. I haven't wavered from my position of foreign policy. I have said this entire campaign, we have to make sure we're keeping America safe, both at home and abroad. And I've mentioned, you know, a number of ways that we can do that. You know, John Katko just feels like he needs to misrepresent me because he doesn't want to run on his record. He doesn't want to run on the fact that he doesn't support common common-sense gun legislation that would keep guns out of the hands of terrorists. I mean, that's something that we should implement right away, and he refuses to support it. So, I mean, if you want to talk about ways we can address this issue, that is a perfect example of how Congressman Katko stands with his party and refuses to support legislation that would prevent terrorists from getting their hands on a gun.
Well, maybe we'll get into that, to the gun issue later. Let me take another piece of messaging here.
If I may, just for just one quick second, respond to that.
Sure, yeah.
She yet has another opportunity to describe what she would do with respect to ISIS after she was being called on this for months. And what she just did there is just a perfect example of what I'm talking about. She didn't answer the question. She didn't propose any plan except some ridiculous generality. The bottom line is she's been exposed to these issues a lot longer than I have. A lot longer, and she still, to this minute, didn't have an issue. She pivots to guns, but I hope we talk about it and give a little time, because I think that's really important.
Okay, well, let's do that then. We'll do guns, and we'll also do this issue. So provide the answer that is the larger answer on how to go about thinking about the challenge from ISIS rather than the soundbite. Go ahead.
John, you know, he took a clip from an interview I did in December. So this is almost a year where I've been saying what I've been saying about ISIS. So for him to say I haven't developed in-depth thought about this topic is completely false,
okay, first of all. So let's hear it.
So, you know, I have said we have to make sure we're keeping America safe. We have to make sure we're keeping Americans safe both here at home and abroad. We have to work with our generals, work with our allies, our coalition partners on the ground to be able to gather the intelligence we need to not only contain but eliminate the threat of ISIS. We need to work with our technology companies to stop ISIS from their online propaganda of recruiting people both here in America and overseas as well. We have to do everything we can to take out ISIS for good. I know we've done we've made some headway. We've been able to reclaim 45% of the territory that ISIS has taken over. We've been able to take over some of the oil fields that they've had. But we have to keep working hard to continue to make sure we're doing everything so that these terrorist organizations aren't threatening us anymore and that we have a strategy moving forward that is smart and not reckless.
Well, so what's missing from that,
sure,
Congressman?
And
be specific.
Of course,
please.
Missing is any specifics. I mean, I'll give you an example. Juxtapose her answer to mine. I was head of the Foreign Fighter Task Force. As a freshman in Congress, I was appointed to head up a task force with four other Republicans and three other Democrats. And our job was to go see firsthand what the threat of ISIS was and then to issue specific recommendations regarding it. And so two-thirds of my answer is going to be regarding that. I issued a 72-page report, and that report is 32 findings and 50 recommendations. Half those recommendations become law. Instead of talking about saying in generalities, well, geez, we got to talk with the internet companies. Well, of course you do. But how? What do? They're telling you they don't want to give up their encryption, so therefore we can't monitor those discussions. So the 32 recommendations, 32 findings, 50 recommendations, that's my blueprint for how to deal with ISIS domestically and in Western Europe, because there's three stages. There's domestic, there's Western Europe, and then there's boots on the ground in Syria and Iraq. And so what we got to do with respect to the last prong is to beef up the bombings, have a robust bombing campaign, and basically take the gloves off. There's too many restrictions with this administration. We need to make sure that ISIS doesn't metastasize more than it already has. We need to make sure that in Afghanistan they don't metastasize. Through the reckless workings of this administration, ISIS now has a stronghold in Libya because it's so destabilized. We also have to make sure that we provide better support. We're providing better support on the ground than we did, and that's allowing ISIS to be on the run. So that's part of it as well. We need to work with our allies to form a more united coalition. And then the last piece of the puzzle, in my opinion, is to take the Middle Eastern nations that are concerned about ISIS and get them to somehow come together and unite against them, because it's kind of a fractured thing now. So that's a difference, because she talks in complete generalities. And again, she's been in this game a lot longer than I have. And I'm talking specifics. I've been in this a year and a half. I think that's a difference.
Can I add to that, Grant?
Very quickly. And
yeah,
then we want to move on.
Nothing that John Katko said was specific. It was all generalities, and half of it was just repeating what I said.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Colleen Deacon and John Katko, the two candidates for Congress in New York's 24th District. Well, we're spending a bit of time on this at the outset, but that's fine. You brought up guns. We said we would do guns. Now, you've delineated your positions on these previously, so I'm going to summarize them here. And what I want to try to get at is where the real difference is. So you brought up the question of denying guns to people on the no-fly list, all right? And your position, and that's you're in favor of this.
Absolutely, yes.
Congressman Katko, you've articulated a different position, which is one of I guess, to see if or to provide a method for the government to prove, in a sense, that there's a danger there and that there's an ability for the individual to protest the decision. So in a sense, you're on somewhat similar grounds.
Well, we absolutely are. We absolutely are. And the only difference between their proposal and mine is that we have constitutional protections built in. Of course I want to keep guns out of the hands of terrorists. For 20 years, I spent my career in a great personal risk to my wife and to myself taking guns off the street. I dealt with the most violent, nasty criminals this world has to offer. And I've had to move out of my home. I've had security issues where we had to move my family out of Puerto Rico and I had to finish a trial down there without them. So to me, this is a serious matter. Now,
on this particular issue, so what is the problem then with just taking this list and saying it's a good place to start, and if you're on this list, if you can't fly, you shouldn't be able to own a gun? What's
because
the problem?
Because guys like Ted Kennedy, a senator, were on that list mistakenly. But the problem with that list is there's an awful lot of people on the list that shouldn't be there. Senator Ted Kennedy was on a no-fly list when he was a United States senator. He'd been a United States senator for decades. He was on the list, and it took him a while to get off it. Now, listen, I'm all for it. I get briefings every day in the basement of the Capitol about national security matters. There's no one who's going after terrorists more than I am. But you've got to do it in the right way. Is the biggest difference between their bill and my bill is that if someone goes into a gun shop and tries to buy a gun, and they're on a no-fly list or any watch list for that matter, right, they're immediately denied getting the gun. And then the Attorney General has 72 hours to certify that, in fact, he's rightfully on the list.
This is your proposal.
Yeah, and once he does that, the guy has a 72-hour waiting period. He comes back and says, can I get the gun? Say, no, you're on a no-fly list and you're there for reasons. So, no, you can't. So I'm not doing it. It's kind of crazy for her to say that I'm not
Deacon,
for that.
So, Ms. Deacon, then, what would be your concern about having that 72-hour period? And why are you not concerned about Ted Kennedy is going to be our example here of Ted Kennedy not being able to get a gun?
Look, if you're on the no-fly list, surely you should not be able to purchase a gun. For those of your listeners who don't know what the no-buy, no-fly is, it means if you're on the no-fly list, if you're a suspected terrorist and you're not able to fly in a plane, you should not be allowed to purchase a gun. I mean, you could go to Hancock Airport and be denied to fly, but then you can go to Vermont and buy an AK-47. You know, we've got to do something to stop this from happening, and I don't think we need to add in 72 hours rule for the state to make a case. I mean, it's just crazy. We can work out people who are on accidentally, but let's make sure we're doing everything to keep America safe.
And how many people are on the no-fly list? How large is it?
I don't know what the number is at this day. In
approximately how many people are
thousands,
on the list?
Thousands of people.
Congressman Kacko, do you know how many people are on this list?
It's a very large number. And the problem is of the actual number of people on a no-fly list that are not Americans, it's quite small. The number of Americans on a no-fly list are quite small. It's like around 900. The number of foreigners on a no-fly list is quite substantial, and they don't have the constitutional rights. But I think she says we can deal with people that are wrongfully listed on a no-fly list. Tell me how you would do that. This is the 72 hours, very common sense. They don't get the gun. The Attorney General, they can make these decisions very quickly because they have the information. They can look there and say, oops, this is not John Smith. This is not the John Smith from Massachusetts who was involved in a bombing or was talking about bombing somebody on the phone. This is John Smith from Arkansas, and this is the same one. Oops, he shouldn't be on there, so yeah, no problem. They can make those decisions quickly. So tell me, if my proposal is flawed, what would you do to ensure that citizens aren't being wrongfully on that list?
Look, let's be honest. John Kacko, I mean, he said when he was running against Dan Maffei, you are where you get your money from. And John Kacko has received thousands of dollars from the gun lobby, thousands of dollars. So he supports the legislation that the gun lobby supports. I mean, I think that's what it boils down to. He knows where, the money that he's receiving from his campaign is where you get your money from, John. You said it yourself. And let's be honest. If you're on the no-fly list, if you're on a terrorist watch list, don't you want to make sure that people don't have the ability to buy a gun and do it as quick as possible? I mean, this is bipartisan, common sense gun legislation that you don't support.
Okay, I think we've reached the end of the difference in the positions here.
I do need to say something, Grant, because this is important. Because
just a couple seconds.
Yeah, but she's talking about me and some being outside influences. You know, go ask the 14 people that are serving mandatory life sentences for gun-related crimes that I put them in prison for, and go ask 160 gang members in Syracuse, New York, who were taking up the streets, gun-related crimes, because of my advocacy. And go ask my wife, who put up with 20 years of the threats that I had to go under just to get guns off the street. Don't ever tell me, or don't ever tell my wife, that I'm not the biggest advocate against gun violence in the United States, because I'm not, because I am.
I'm going to move on, because we've covered my first question. So
this always happens. You know that.
I do have more questions about your messaging, and this is important, I think, to cover in terms of the candidates owning and being able to explain the messaging that most people see most of the time. So, Congressman, I have another one for you, and then Ms. Deacon, I have two questions for you. Let's try to be briefer, though, on these. Congressman, another theme of your messaging is that Ms. Deacon will not depart from her party leadership if she's elected. Now, since she's not held elective office, that claim is necessarily a prediction. Why are you making that claim?
Because I'm just using her own words. She was asked point blank in an interview on Time Warner Cable whether or not what she would do with break with the party. And they specifically asked her, what would you do to break with the party and tell Nancy Pelosi, no, I'm going to work with the Republicans on this one? And her answer was, I can't think of anything I disagree with the Republicans on. So then she went back on the show a while later, had an opportunity to answer the question again, and she says, oh, it's about I would break with them on trade. Well, the Democratic platform is anti-trade agreement anyway, so that's not breaking with your party. It's breaking with Obama. And she still to this day hasn't given an example.
All right, so we'll get into that then. Ms. Deacon, I'm put this question to you. Going on the assumption, I think it's a reasonable one at this point when we're talking, that Hillary Clinton is elected president, therefore Hillary Clinton will be your party's leader. Are there any significant policy areas where you take a different view from Hillary Clinton?
Well, first I want to go back to, you know, John lives in a selective editing world. The Liz Benjamin interview that he's talking about, they cut it off right before I said, but I am an independent
voice.
But
you have the opportunity here to tell me where you would take a different view.
I agree,
view
but
from
I just
Clinton.
Want to make it clear that, again, John is misleading the voters with these ads.
Okay.
Second of all, Hillary Clinton, absolutely. You know, she is somebody who has kind of waffled on the fracking issue, and it's something I'm anti-fracking. I have been anti-fracking this whole entire campaign. I mean, here in Syracuse, we've got Onondaga Lake. We've got one of the most polluted lakes in the country, and Skaneateles Atlas Lake, one of the cleanest. So we know firsthand what happens if we were to pollute our waters. That is a position I have been very firm on. You know, Trans-Pacific Partnership, I know John thinks I'm not breaking from my party, but he just said that it was Obama's legislation. Last I checked, Obama was in my party.
Okay, I'm asking about Hillary Clinton.
Well, and that's where I was going, okay. Is that she had, you know, she's kind of changed her position on Trans-Pacific Partnership as well, which is something I have been firmly against. Since I've been on this campaign trail, I've been talking about it. It's something that I've talked about that's been in the news. And something, you know, John, who says he's against it, but the only reason he's against it is because Obama has the ability to do the deal, not because he cares about the American workers, but because he doesn't want Obama to be able to make the deal.
Let me interject now. Are there any significant policy? So for Hillary Clinton, you specified fracking, where she's waffled, and the TPP, where she has changed her view and is now against it, and you're against it too. Are there any significant policy areas where you take a different view from Nancy Pelosi?
Well, I think, you know, at this point, I know Guantanamo Bay was something that people were, you know, working through and working on. And, you know, prior to this debate today, I was against closing Guantanamo Bay. I don't think we have a plan in place that would really prevent bad actors from getting onto American soil. So that was something that I was going to stand firmly against to make sure that we're not, you know, putting American lives in danger.
Okay. If you just joined us, you're listening to a candidate debate from WRVO Public Media between John Katko and Colleen Deacon. They're vying for the 24th congressional seat in New York.
If I may just briefly respond. She still hasn't said anything of substance. She said anti-fracking. Hillary's anti-fracking. Now, it's on the record. It's on the Democratic platform. And TPP is on the Democratic platform. That's not a break. And the first time since she's been in this campaign for over a year, she's finally said something that she's against closing Guantanamo Bay. I congratulate you. That's a good thing to find something that you disagree with your party, because I do that every day in my job in Washington.
I want to turn now, though, to some of Ms. Deacon's messaging. So we looked at yours. Now I want to look at Ms. Deacon's. Ms. Deacon, much of your messaging in this campaign has focused on women and women's issues, and you've connected those to Donald Trump. You organized something that you labeled a rally by Central New York women against Katko and Trump. That was the heading on your press release. The photograph that your campaign released showed 15 women on the steps of Syracuse City Hall. So I have three linked questions here for you. Do you think that John Katko is like Donald Trump in some important way? What should he have done or said differently regarding Donald Trump's campaign, and why is that important here in Central New York?
Well, thank you. I appreciate the question. Absolutely. You know, John Kako is somebody who said he would support Donald Trump, you know, back during the Republican primaries. Then over the summer, he said, oh, I don't know, he's got to earn my vote. He kind of waffled on the idea of Donald Trump. But, you know, Donald Trump had called women pigs. He said Mexicans were rapist in the first kickoff of his campaign. He's insulted entire religions, mocked people with disabilities. So, I mean, I don't know how you could earn his vote after all of the terrible things that he said. And then just recently, you know, after these tapes came out of Donald Trump on a hot mic saying terrible, terrible things that I can't even repeat here. 30 days before an election, John Kako decides that it's too much for him. And once he got a permission slip from Paul Ryan, he decided to jump off the Trump train.
So your argument then is that he should have denounced and said he wasn't going to vote for or endorse Trump much earlier on.
Absolutely. I've been saying it for months since I've been on this campaign. That's something that we've really been focusing on. I mean, Donald Trump is unfit to be president, and for
now,
John to stand with him is scary.
A lot of prominent Republicans have gone through this process as well. So why is this important? Why is that sequence important here?
Well, I think it shows leadership. It shows who John Kako really is. I mean, he's somebody who says something on the campaign trail and does something completely different when he gets to Washington. He waited until he saw, you know, the way the political, the way the polls were showing before he decided to jump off the Trump train.
Okay, so let me turn to Congressman Katko now. Why, Congressman, did you wait until you did to formally not endorse Donald Trump?
I didn't wait. During the primary process, I said that when there were 17 candidates, I said I would support whomever the Republican nominee is. I never said anybody in particular. I said I support the nominee. She's taken those words and should say that I've endorsed Donald Trump. Never have. From the moment he was a nominee, I was profoundly concerned about the things he said. And I was asked point-blank questions, but what do you think about the Constitution, about the barring immigrants and everything else? I've been made it perfectly clear I completely disagree with him. And from the moment this he was a nominee, I've said I do not. I have serious concerns. I withheld support. I withheld saying I was going to vote for him, and withheld saying I was going to endorse him. I've never endorsed him. I've never said I was going to vote for him. And so, what happened during the only thing that happened on the weekend after that tape came out was I came out and said that not only am I not going to support him and not vote for him, like I said, I never said I was going to the whole time, I also think he should step down. Now, think about that from a courage standpoint, to stand that strong to your party. And juxtapose that with Ms. Deacon, who is completely 100% in the tank for Hillary Clinton, who is probably, she's the second most unpopular presidential nominee in the history of our country, to be surpassed only by Donald Trump. And I've stood up to him, and she's not standing, she hasn't stood up to one thing about Hillary Clinton. And there's profound problems with her.
All right, I want to turn to that.
John Kako
very, very
said
quickly.
That Donald Trump has good principles. He said he was going to support the Republican nominee. These are his words. So if he's trying to backtrack now, I think it shows he waited until it was politically expedient, 30 days before an election, after 30 members of Congress who are running jumped off the Trump train.
I'm going to jump back in here. Congressman, just in a couple seconds,
sure.
What are the principles that Donald Trump has that you agree with? What are they?
Listen, the one thing I agree with is that we're getting screwed on our trade deals. There's no question about that. I don't agree with his moral principles because I think they're lacking. And, you know, Ms. Deacon is revising history here. It's absolutely clear. I've never endorsed him, and I never said I was going to vote for him. So listen carefully to her words. She's trying to splice things together here,
okay.
And it's just not true.
All right, I want to move to another one. Ms. Deacon, another prominent theme of your messaging is that Congressman Katko is not a moderate, that is just an appearance, and that actually he is a conservative who's loyal to the conservative core of the Republican Party in Congress when it counts. What specific evidence do you have for making that claim?
Well, look, he's somebody, when he ran for Congress, he promised he wouldn't vote to defund Planned Parenthood. And since he's been in office, he's done just that four times. He's somebody, when he ran, he said he wouldn't let a terrorist get their hands on a gun, and he does not support the no-buy, no-fly. He's somebody who, when he ran for office, he said he was going to focus on jobs in the economy. But he's focused on anything but jobs in the economy in this district because the Republican Party hasn't worked on a jobs package to help provide opportunities for people.
So what makes him not a moderate, then, is the Planned Parenthood votes, the difference between you on the way you're going to approach the no-fly no buy issue.
And I'll also add, too, in the environment. I mean, okay. John Kako, when he ran, he didn't even – he couldn't say that climate change was man-made. And he's voted against legislation that would help our environment, help improve global warming. So I think these are huge issues to show. He'll say something on the campaign trail, do something completely different in D.C., and is not a moderate, is only focused on himself, winning re-election, and his party.
Congressman Kako, then, why should voters view you as a moderate Republican?
Because multiple independent groups have rated me that one of the most independent persons in all of Congress. I have 15 bills passed the House. 15. My predecessor had zero in 4 years. Six of them have been signed into law. In every single one of those bills, the first co-sponsor in the bill is a Democrat. You don't get there by being a hardcore conservative like my opponent tries to paint me to be. You get there by being a principled, independent person who's willing to break with their party when necessary to get things done. And those bills aren't about naming post offices. They're about keeping this country safe. They're about getting heroin off the streets of our country and keeping them out of our, and reducing the number of funerals that people have for heroin. And it's also about keeping our airports safe. That's pretty meaty stuff. And for a freshman to have that type of responsibility and that type of success, you do not get it when you're as she's trying to paint me to be. You just can't. It just won't happen.
You're listening to a debate from WRVO Public Media with the candidates for New York's 24th Congressional District, incumbent Republican John Katko and Democratic challenger Colleen Deacon. I want to turn now to some more specific policy issues, and we'll start domestically and work outward. Some of our listeners have asked me to ask the two of you about infrastructure and about I-81. Ms. Deacon, what specifically should the federal government be doing about the nation's infrastructure, and how high of a national spending priority should it be relative to other priorities?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Infrastructure is something I've been talking about this entire campaign. I think it is imperative that we invest heavily in our infrastructure. I mean, our roads, bridges, water and sewer pipes are crumbling, you know, and the time to act is now. They're not going to fix themselves. We have water pipes in the city of Syracuse that are made out of wood and are over 100 years old. And it seems like we're seeing a water main break every winter, every day. So I think an investment in infrastructure is imperative, not only for, you know, to help improve our infrastructure, but also to create jobs. I think this is an awesome opportunity for us to be able to put thousands of people directly to work. You know, these are jobs you cannot outsource. You know, we can put people, give them the skills, you know, give them the tools they need to be able to help improve our roads, our bridges, our water, and our super highways, and also improve our economy at the same time. I would be fully supportive of any investment in infrastructure. I think it's huge.
Is there something that you're willing to give up or spend less on in order to spend more on that?
It's all about priorities. I mean, let's look at the budget. Let's look and see where we can take away and put in. But at the same time, too, I mean, we're talking about borrowing dollars at, you know, record low interest rates, you know, next to nothing, to be able to put people to work, to invest in our infrastructure and add dollars to our economy. It almost will pay for itself in the long run.
So if spending more on the nation's infrastructure involved raising the deficit higher and increasing the national debt, you would be okay with that?
I don't think we should be encouraging raising the national debt, but at the same time, I think we need to look at it as an investment. Look at it, you know, 10 years down the road. What is the payoff? Let's not just look to tomorrow like the Republicans are doing right now, seeing spending as bad as opposed to looking at it as an investment. So I am all for, you know, investing in our infrastructure, putting people to work, and improving our roads and bridges and water and sewer pipes.
The other part of this, do you have a position on the two remaining options for I-81, a new version of the elevated highway and a street level boulevard?
I've been working in this district for the last 12 years. I've been hearing directly from people, from leaders, talking about how this is such an important issue for the future of this region. You know, we have to be bold about this. We have to look at this not about just tomorrow, but the next 75, 100 years. And, you know, what we saw in the 50s, it was a top-down approach, and the community was not included. And I want to make sure that the community is included.
Okay, but do you have a position? Do you have a position on the two remaining options for I-81? It's a new version of the elevated highway and a street-level boulevard. The decision has to come from the state, and be pushed up to the national government, and the local leaders are all taking positions on this. Do you have a position
at this point? You know, I think we need to look at the data, look at, you know, what the draft environmental impact statement says in December, and then decide, you know, once we have the facts and the figures, to really make a strong decision about what we should do for this community. But I will add too, it should come from the community. It should come from people of this district. It shouldn't come from a top-down approach. It should come from people who are living here.
Congressman Katko, do you have any different views from what you just heard on either infrastructure and the way to think of it as a national spending priority, or the positions on I-81?
Well, we've already made it a national spending priority. When I was campaigning, the suggestions of my campaign manager at the time, they said, don't make promises during the campaign. I made the promise that I was going to get a long-term highway bill passed. After 35 short-term extensions over the last decade that completely stifled highway construction projects because they didn't know whether they were going to have money in 2 months because they kept a series of continuing resolutions, we delivered the first long-term highway bill in a decade. And I was a lead negotiator as a freshman on that bill. I was even appointed to the conference committee to meld the Senate and House versions of that bill. And that bill plussed up spending for highway infrastructure and related projects by 10% over the span of the project. And I'm very happy to report that I also was one who was able to get Interstate 81 designated a high priority corridor, which is ensuring that that's going to be properly funded and that during the environmental impact review, it's going to get the proper attention. I was also able, as part of that, to restore $15 million in cuts that were coming to Centro that would have crippled them and crippled people's ability to get to work. So we have already started with that. The roads and bridges, you see the construction projects are already starting, and it's a start. I mean, there's also things we can do, I think, that we got to start thinking more about. The water systems nationwide are struggling. We saw what happened in Flint. I'm an advocate, and I advocated for the city of Syracuse on their behalf when I received some requests from the mayor to do so, to support the clean water grant programs that are block grants to the states. We need to beef those up.
So what about this? The same issue, though, about, okay, so you've delineated a lot of new mm-hmm. spending and the importance mm-hmm. of it. Where are you willing to give up some spending in order to provide more infrastructure
support? Sure, I'm sorry. Yeah, we already did. And I'll tell you what we did for the highway bill. We should do the same thing for the others. The highway bill didn't increase spending. It found other areas. They're saying in Congress we have now what's it pay for. In other words, no new spending without finding cuts elsewhere in government. I know this is going to come as a shock to you and the listeners out there, but there's a significant amount of fraud, waste, and abuse in the government. And we can find areas where you can cut. We should find those areas to cut. And we keep doing it. And then one of the areas that may be an area that's going to be, from an infrastructure standpoint, might help, is to bring the repatriation of foreign corporate assets. There's trillions of dollars overseas that has been sitting there because of this tax structure in the United States. If we incentivize those corporations to come back home and then to use that increased tax revenue for infrastructure projects, that's one thing I think that one
so, thing so to do. Interject again, you think that we can make the investment in the nation's infrastructure that we need to make without borrowing more money in order to do it?
We have to, and you know, and we're doing it, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to find ways to do it. And again, I just said we plussed up spending on the highway bill in that first long-term highway bill in a decade, and it plussed up spending by 10%, and we didn't increase taxes to do so.
What about I-81? Do you have? And we'll give you Ms. Deegan a chance to respond quickly here in a minute, but the other piece of this, do you have a position on the two remaining options for I-81?
No, I don't. My job as a federal person is to deliver the dollars, which I've done, and to make sure that Interstate 81 is going to be properly funded, which it is. My job now is to make sure that all four areas were properly funded. And if you remember back in January when I first got into office, they were going to issue a scoping report that back then that only had the Boulevard and Viaduct options. And through my advocacy, they delayed the implementation of the scoping report for 4 months to include the tunnel option and the recessed highway. Those have been knocked out because of cost, and probably justifiably so. But the other two options now, I have to make sure that the outlying areas, like I've been advocating for DeWitt to have town hall meetings. Tonight, Skaneateles Atlas is going to have a town hall meeting, and Auburn. The outlying areas need to have discussions on this highway, because if it becomes a boulevard, people are going to be cutting through those small towns to get south to 81 and west to on the thruway, and we need to make sure they understand the increase in road traffic and that DOT understands that and puts that as part of the overall plan to make sure the roads can handle it.
Ms. Deegan, I want to give you just a very, very quick chance. You wanted to rebut a couple things, and then I do want to move on to another issue. So very briefly, please.
Well, I just wanted to add, too, you know, John said that he was helped get this infrastructure legislation through. Well, it was not nearly the type of investment we need. We need to see significant investment, and this was, you know, just baseline increases to what we had previously. Second of all, you know, I think John mentioned something about repatriation and bringing companies back onto our land after they moved their headquarters overseas. He voted against legislation coming to the floor to do that. So how can he say he wants to see companies come back onto our soil when he's actually preventing legislation from getting to the floor?
All right. Very quick on that last issue, then we are moving on. Congressman?
It's just not true, period.
Okay. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Colleen Deacon and John Katko, the two candidates for Congress in New York's 24th District. I want to move on now to another issue, the Affordable Care Act. It has had some successes over the years in terms of insurance coverage and overall costs. But it has hit a pretty big bump in the road in terms of premium increases for the plans and the exchange, and some previous supporters have now begun to express some concerns about it. So, Congressman Katko, is it time to seriously rethink this legislation? What specific kinds of changes would you want?
Sure. I absolutely think it's time to. I mean, like you just said, the increases in premiums are a huge problem. You have Aetna, the largest insurer nationwide, pulling out of the exchanges. You have the cooperatives on the exchanges that have gone belly up or are going belly up nationwide. And one of the fundamental principles of Obamacare was that you're going to get millions of young Americans to come out, that healthy young Americans come onto the healthcare exchange. It hasn't happened, so the funding mechanism isn't there. And that's part of the reason why the prices are being driven up. There's some good ideas about Obamacare. Having up to a 26-year-old on your policy, great idea. We should keep that. Having portability of insurance when you have a pre-existing condition, absolutely. Things like that are a good idea. And the premise of having insurance for everybody available in the United States, absolutely, we should keep that. But there is a better idea, and we've got the skeleton outline of one, and quite frankly, part of it's based on my advocacy. I stood up to my party time and again when they voted to repeal Obamacare without a replacement. I'm very proud of that, and I kept my campaign promise to do that. And I did that because I wanted to force the leadership to tell them, people like me are not going to support these ridiculous votes unless there's something ready to go. And because of that, there's a working group that's come up with a skeleton outline of a plan that's going to basically have a more of a market-based solution to Obamacare, where people are going to be able to have insurance, and they're going to get incentivized to get insurance either through tax rebates or through tax credits. And also, it opened up competition for insurance companies across state lines to establish high-risk pools, because that's what's really causing a lot of this funding cost. It's not the healthy people. It's the people that are really sick. And we need to have the government support for those high-risk insurance pools. That's going to help keep the cost down. And there's many other things, but that's basically a skeletal outline of it.
Ms. Deacon, the same question about the Affordable Care Act. Do you think it's time to seriously rethink this legislation, and what specific kinds of changes would you be willing to support?
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting that John just said there's a skeletal outline for a new plan. Skeletal outline, it's been 6 years. It takes that long to come up with a new plan when you just said that it has a lot of good aspects, like allowing students to stay on their parents' plan until they're 26, or to not allow insurance companies to deny people with pre-existing conditions. So it sounds like, hey, a great skeletal plan is the Affordable Care Act. Let's work to make it better. Let's work to improve it. You know, as somebody who didn't have health insurance for a time in my life, I know how valuable it is for people to be able to have the option to go to the doctor, to get, you know, the health care that they deserve. You know, some of the things I think that we can do to look to improve it is let's repeal the excise tax, which means if you sign up for a high-cost health care plan, right now there's a 40% tax on top of that. And I don't think that's fair for, people who maybe signed up for a high-cost health care plan because maybe they wanted to get good benefits, but, you know, their salary is a little bit lower. So let's make sure we're working with people so they have the opportunity to have affordable, quality health care. But let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's work to improve it and make it better.
That's pretty much what I'm saying. I mean, whether you call it a radical restructuring, which it desperately needs.
John, you have said you wanted to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
No, I said only if there is a replacement. I said radical restructuring or repeal. Either way, unless there's a replacement ready to go, I would be against it, and I'd back that up with my words.
Could you, Ms. Deacon, maybe follow up a little bit and speak a little bit more specifically about the kinds of changes that you really would want to see?
Sure. I just mentioned repealing the excise tax. And I agree with you. I think we need to get the cost down. You know, as somebody, actually, I was on the exchange when I was working in the senator's office. And although my monthly payment went down, my deductible went up. So, you know, I experienced it.
But the excise tax, we're really talking about a marginal change there. So I'm really wondering, do we really need to rethink something important about this law?
No, I think the Affordable Care Act is a great first step. Absolutely. I think we need to improve it, make it better. But I'm pleased that we're looking at the 19 million Americans who now have health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act.
Okay, let me move on. Listeners have also asked me to ask you about the environment and climate change. So, Ms. Deacon, last month, President Obama signed an executive order requiring that impacts on climate change be factored into national security policies and plans. Do you think the United States needs to become more proactive in addressing climate change? And if so, again, what trade-offs should the nation be willing to confront in order to do that?
Well, look, I think, you know, climate change and global warming is one of the biggest threats that we face, and we have to take it very, very seriously. I mean, I've talked about this issue the entire campaign. It is something that we, you know, we have to look at it, you know, how it's affecting our entire world. You know, there are places in the Middle East right now where kids are joining terrorist groups because they don't have any other options. Their farming has been in a drought for the last 10 years. So that's, you know, that's why we're seeing, you know, the terrorist groups being able to recruit so many people. And we have to understand that this is a problem worldwide. We also need to look at it, I think, as an economic opportunity. You know, we've got we need to transition off of fossil fuels and into renewable energies. Let's take some of our old factories and turn them into wind turbine production facilities or solar panel production facilities. Let's use it as an opportunity to help America lead by example and, you know, really be able to capture the renewable energy sector. I think it's the step we have to take. We have to look forward. You know, we have to make sure that we're keeping our water and our air safe for, you know, my generation, my son's generation, and for future generations to come.
Congressman Katko, do you have any different views on those questions about how to address climate change and the priority it should have and what trade-offs the nation should be willing to take?
Sure. Slightly. I have a slightly different view. I think, you know, we have to face the reality that renewable energy is not advanced enough to solve the problem entirely. I absolutely agree with it. We got to keep championing going to windmills, for example, and solar energy, but it's not there yet, and it's going to be a long time. Every expert says that. I've supported legislation to shift funding from fossil fuels to renewables, especially with respect to research, because that's important for us to do that. I also have supported keeping new factories being built, having more strict carbon emission standards. But you also have to balance that with the fact that the economy. And it's borderline economic suicide for us to unilaterally disarm completely on carbon emissions, and while the rest of the world gains a competitive advantage because it costs more to produce goods in the United States. So we have to balance the two. And I think going forward, I've reflected that in the way I've implemented my environmental policies. And quite frankly, I think they're working because a lot of environmental groups are supporting me. I got home yesterday in my house, and I got something in the mail from another environmental group championing me being a good environmentalist and finding the proper balance. But the bottom line is, I agree with her. It is a profound problem. I don't think it's why ISIS came to existence, though, is global warming. ISIS came to existence because of hatred for the West. And the bottom line is, going forward, I think we need to have a policy for renewables that is going to balance the business interests and to keep jobs here, but also to make sure that we're doing everything we can.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a candidate debate from WRVO Public Media between John Katko and Colleen Deacon. They're vying for the 24th congressional seat in New York. Well, I want to – you both have mentioned trade, and I wanted to come back to that. It has received a lot of attention during this election, and again, it's been part of your messaging as well. So, Ms. Deacon, I'll stick with you for the first question here. Can you explain specifically how the Trans-Pacific Partnership would affect the economy in central New York? How exactly would that produce big job losses for the region?
Yeah, I mean, what we saw, you know, with NAFTA, you know, thousands of jobs have left this district over the last 30 years, and it's because of these trade deals. I mean, I'm all for trade and making sure that, you know, it's a global economy, but we have to make sure it's on a level playing field. We have to make sure that when we're entering into these agreements with other countries, that we have the same environmental standards, that we have the same safety standards, that we have the same pay and benefit standards. Because if we don't, then that's not fair, and that puts the American worker at a disadvantage. You know, right now we are seeing a trade deficit with other countries. And this, you know, we have to be cognizant of the fact that we need to make sure that American workers are the ones that are going to be able to go to work every day and have opportunity, not workers in other countries. You know, I'm fully supportive, again, of trade deals, but we have to make sure that they help the American worker and give them opportunities.
Congressman Katko, I wanted to get your reaction to one specific claim Ms. Deacon made, and it's, I've talked to my economist colleagues about this. Do you agree with her that the main job losses in this area have been because of trade deals?
I think it's definitely a contributing factor, and I'll tell you why. Because when I was talking to folks on the floor about the TPA, which was passed with Obama's pushing, and then against my objections, and another example why I broke my party, but then also the TPP, which is coming up, I had people look me in the eye and say, you know, John, there's winners and losers in these deals in the United States, and quite frankly, Northeast is probably going to continue to be a loser in these deals. Well, I don't accept that, and I absolutely positively think that we can fix this by not getting into these ruinous trade deals. These trade deals are allowing jobs to be exported to other countries. And we know that for the last 30,000 jobs have left Central New York since NAFTA. Now, some people argue it wasn't because of NAFTA. It was because of lower labor costs elsewhere. And I know that because I saw one as a prosecutor in El Paso across the border. They're paying $1.50 an hour for people working Ford plants. I understand that. But the bottom line is those deals are ruined. So I agree with Ms. Deacon regarding that. But I have a way to – if you'll indulge me a moment, I have a solution. And that is – before we enter into these trade deals and decide who in the United States can be winners and losers, I think we should take a step back and see why are we losing jobs overseas and why are companies moving overseas at record numbers? They're moving overseas because it's wicked expensive to do business here. The playing field is not level. I have great faith in the American worker, the ingenuity. I've visited pretty much every factory in this district, some of them multiple times. They are lean and mean, and they are succeeding against unbelievable odds. And I'm convinced that if we leveled the playing field from a tax structure and from a tariff structure, that we would absolutely, positively bring those jobs back. And then people would be knocking on the doors to do business with us. And we would have our economy flourishing, and it would also help the poverty issue. So I think leveling the playing field internationally is the priority one before we enter any more of these ruinous trade deals. So she's right. These trade deals stink. And I think we need to take a look at the bigger picture.
Ms. Deacon, let me just give you a very brief opportunity to respond to just the last part of what the congressman said there about another way to look at the possible ways to remedy the problem that you're both identifying.
Well, I mean, what specifically?
Well, I'm sorry. I saw you nod. I saw you shaking your head there. I mean,
well, look, so. I mean, I mentioned earlier, John Katko, the only reason he voted against the Trade Promotion Authority was because Obama was the one that was the lead negotiator. It wasn't, you know, he's quoted in the Auburn Citizen as saying that he doesn't think Obama can make the deal. Second of all, you know, I'd add, you know, he says about corporations moving overseas. I mentioned it again. He has blocked legislation from coming to the floor that would end these tax loopholes. So, you know, he says something on the campaign trail and does something completely different when he's in D.C.
I need to respond
on that last point. Sure. Only, please.
Sure. I mean, first of all, that's not true what you're saying. And second of all, the reason I voted against a trade deal is because I, too, saw a lot of my friends and a lot of family members lose jobs because of what happened over the last 30 years here. And I desperately love Central New York, and I don't want people moving overseas or losing their jobs because of these trade deals. And when someone looks me in the eye and says, John, there's winners and losers in these trade deals, and I said, well, not for me. And that's why I stuck up for these people, and that's why, quite frankly, I've got tremendous support from the trade unions and labor unions because they are supporting me because they know that I've got it right and I understand what they're going through and what they've gone through.
I want to move now to the Middle East. There are so many questions that could be asked related to the Middle East, but I want to try to boil it down to this if possible. Normally, in recent American politics, when it comes to the use of force internationally, Republicans are typically quicker to exercise that option than Democrats, but this is not a normal year. And one of the concerns that has been raised by Democrats during the primary and by others since is that Hillary Clinton seems to be a little more hawkish than Barack Obama, more willing to involve the United States militarily overseas. In some ways, Donald Trump seems less eager to commit troops abroad, but he also talks very aggressively in other ways. So I want to use the Obama years as the comparison point here for this question. And Ms. Deacon, I'll start with you. Would you regard yourself as more or less eager than President Obama to employ force internationally, given the region as it is right now, or were you about the same on that issue?
Look, I think, you know, boots on the ground is our last resort. We can't, you know, send troops overseas in these endless wars. You know, my father's a veteran. My two uncles were Vietnam. And I, you know, I see firsthand how these wars can affect families. But, you know, we have to do everything that we can to make sure that we're fighting ISIS and we're, you know, eliminating these threats. And I can tell you, you know, Hillary Clinton, she has the knowledge about foreign policy. And Donald Trump, I mean, he is somebody who is completely unfit, doesn't have the understanding or the ability to be able to be our commander-in-chief. I mean, he's somebody that's terrifying to think about having the nuclear codes. He's somebody who has called our generals that they've been reduced to rubble. He said our POWs.
But I want to focus on the comparison to the last 8 years. And again, you know, the likely outcome of this presidential election is that Hillary Clinton is going to be the president. So focus on that. I mean, how do you see yourself in comparison to what's happened in the last 8 years? You say boots on the ground are the last option, but can you give me and can you give voters a general sense of where you sort of – your basic orientation on this? Because, again, there is concern among Democrats that Hillary Clinton is more likely to involve the United States in a protracted intervention over there in that area.
Well, again, you know, boots on the ground is a last resort. I mean, we have to, you know, have all of the options on the table, but obviously, you know, making sure that we're only use them if necessary. I mean, this is a crisis, and we do need to, you know, work together to make sure we're doing everything we can to help, you know, stabilize the Middle East for good. So, you know, I would look at, you know, every idea, every piece of legislation, everything that comes my way and judge it appropriately at that time.
Congressman Katko, can you place yourself relative to the last 8 years?
Absolutely. Well, to begin with, Barack Obama's Neville Chamberlain on steroids. By that I mean he thinks he can win over his enemies through appeasement. I can tell you from being a gang prosecutor for 20 years, the only thing the bad guys understand, like Putin and like the Iran and the folks in North Korea, is strength. Ronald Reagan projected strength because they knew they didn't want to test Ronald Reagan. You can't do that by trying to have appeasement. When you have appeasement, you have ruinous deals like the Iran nuclear deal, which my opponent supports, which is a terrible thing. The bottom line is Hillary Clinton, let's not forget, ISIS metastasized on her watch. ISIS in Libya was destabilized on her watch in her advocacy. The Middle East was destabilized through her advocacy, thinking that these nations could all of a sudden magically become democracies. And those are the types of things you've got to consider. Now, on the other hand, projecting strength, whether it be from Hillary Clinton or from Donald Trump, I think is critically important. Having a strong, well-funded military and the bad guys looking you in the eye and sizing you up and saying, okay, I don't know if I want to test this person. Well, Hillary came in and she wanted to have the quote-unquote reset with Russia. What happened? Russia all of a sudden invaded the Crimea, and for the first time in 40 years, they're involved in Syria. Aleppo is a mess because the Syrian regime is being backed by Putin. And they haven't been in Syria for 40 years. So whomever the two people are, I think having strength and the character to look them in the eye and say, you do this and there's going to be a problem. But I do not, under any sense, and I agree with her on one point, I think boots on the ground should be a very last resort. And I say that from a very personal standpoint. I have a 21-year-old son who I had to swear into the Army, who's in the Army National Guard. He's graduating Geneseo as an officer. If there's a conflict, he's going. He's in the infantry, and he's going to go as an officer, and he'll be on the front line. So for his sake and everyone else's, we shouldn't put anybody in harm's way unless it's absolutely positive for the last resort.
We only have a couple seconds left, literally a couple seconds. Ms. Deacon, I want to give you the last word. Is there anything that you just heard there that you want to respond to?
No, I mean, I think this is a extremely important issue, something we should absolutely be focused on every single day to make sure that we're keeping Americans safe and doing everything we can. You know, I respect John's son's choice to join the military. I think that's very commendable. And I'm glad to know that we have soldiers who are willing to go to war and help keep us free.
Thank you.
This has been a conversation from WRVO Public Media with the two candidates for Congress in the 24th District of New York, Democratic challenger Colleen Deacon and incumbent Republican John Katko. Thanks again to the two of you for talking.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
A reminder that the full audio of this debate, along with the transcript, is available at WRVO.org. This has been a production of WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher. Thank you for joining us.